From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, some great conversations with amazing artists and big thinkers. British director Amma Asante discusses her career and her work on the film A United Kingdom. And Arlo Guthrie reflects on his music and our political climate. But first, Cheech Marin is best known as one half of the influential comedy duo Cheech and Chong. He's written a new memoir about his life and career. It's called Cheech Is Not My Real Name, But Don't Call Me Chong. He joins us now to tell us more. Cheech, good to see you, my friend.
It was always nice to see you, Tavis.
Man, so I didn't know the backstory for how you got this nickname.
Oh, yeah.
But the story itself is funny.
When I was a little baby, just come home from the hospital, 2 days old, and my uncle looked in the crib and he said in Spanish, "Ay, parece un chicharrón, looks like a little chicharrón." And chicharrón is our pork rinds, you know, pig skins are all curled up, they're like a Mexican potato chip, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, so that stuck in the family. So it was always chicharrón, they shortened it to Cheech right away.
That's not the best compliment.
Well,
that
I don't.
That you look like a...
Well, if you're Mexican, it has a certain connotation.
Yeah. And that name stuck all those years.
Yeah, in my family.
Yeah.
To the rest of the world, I was Richard.
Yeah.
And then when Tommy and I were trying to come up with a name for our duo, now duo, he said, well, we're talking Richard and Tommy, Marin and Chong. Yeah. He said, do you have a nickname? And he said, well, Cheech is my nickname. And he said, Cheech and Chong, and that was it.
Yeah, but isn't that funny though? How things? I mean, you're literally coming home from the hospital.
Yeah.
You get this nickname, but the nickname works so well with Chong, and the rest is history.
That's fate.
Yeah.
What can I say? Yeah, it is. You know.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful.
I had no idea. I mean, I learned so much about you in the book, which is why I guess you wrote it. I guess. Yeah.
Well, the statute of limitations on a lot of that stuff is over, and so I cannot talk about it.
Speaking of statute of limitations. I had no idea, and it's funny given the subjects of your movies and the trouble you got yourself into. You're the son of a cop.
Yeah.
Your dad was a cop.
LAPD, 30 years.
Like, how did that happen? That you end up.
You know, I don't. There was a family profession. Two of my other uncles were cops. My uncle Rudy, he's not really uncle, he's Mexican uncle.
Sure.
And he was the highest ranking Chicano in the force. They named the Hollenbeck Station after him.
Yeah.
And so that was the family business, you know. So it was cool for me.
And you didn't feel chastised about your behavior, given that your father is an officer of the law?
Funny thing is, cops were our biggest fans.
Yeah.
Really, wherever we went.
Yeah.
Because they got the humor of it. They dealt with those people every day.
Yeah.
And we had these kind of amiable personalities. And they thought, my dad loved it because he was working juvenile all those years. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted free records to give all to the juvies, man.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, ever heard of Cheech and Chong? Yeah. Well, he's my son. Here's a free album. Come over here. Yeah. So have you seen this guy?
You know? You got to use what you got, man.
Yeah, you know.
I was thinking, and I'm so glad you talked about it in the text, in the book, but this is the 30th anniversary of Born in East L.A.
Wow.
And for those of us who know the movie and know what the movie is all about, what do you make of this being the 30th anniversary of that film in this moment of immigration being such a...
It's like Groundhog Day, you know? It keeps happening over and over and over again. We don't seem to have learned it. We seem to know less about the subject right now in that whole process. But, you know, I view it like a lava flow. You know, you can stand in front of it. I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
But this interweaving of Mexico and the United States is never going to be unwoven.
Yeah.
Never, ever.
Yeah.
And nor do we want it to be. Mexico is our biggest allies.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you make? I don't mean to make you political unless you want to go there. But what do you make of the all-out assault and affront on the issue of immigration?
You know, I don't think it's based. It's based on fear.
Yeah.
And it's based on not a lot of information. You know, I travel the country. Just I'm sure a lot of people do, but I travel the country all the time, and I see the integration of the Latino influence all over. I mean, New York, the biggest concentration of Latinos are Mexican in New York City. Chicago, second biggest concentration of Mexicans in the country. Topeka, Kansas has more Mexican restaurants than McDonald's. You know, so and it is a gift to the country, not a threat.
Yeah. How were you treated or maltreated as a kid growing up because of your background?
Well, I was Mexican in a black neighborhood, so you know, yo Mexican, You know, I grew up in South Central LA when it was predominantly 90-some% black and the rest Latino and one lost white guy running around there, you know. And but so it was normal for me. That was all my friends. That's who I went to school with. And there's a good story in there about Bobo Brazil, the wrestler.
Yeah,
the wrestler. Sure. Yep. And you know, so then my dad was involved in the shooting at next door, at the barbershop next door. And then we moved after that, a couple of years after that, to Granada Hills. Mm-hmm. And so one day, everybody in our neighborhood was black, and the next day, everybody was white. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, how does this go? I don't know this tune.
As a kid, how did you process that?
I kind of ignored it, you know, unless they kind of confronted me, but it was like an opportunity to like live in the country and hear crickets and orange groves and, you know, stuff like that.
But how did you process though going from an all black neighborhood to an all white neighborhood?
It's a change, man. And I just like, okay, I was always the littlest kid. In every class I was in. So that's kind of how I process this. I'm a little kid in this new neighborhood, and these are, everybody's bigger. It didn't really matter to me if they were black or white. They were bigger.
Yeah. You mentioned Bobo Brazil. Go ahead and tell the story.
Bobo Brazil was
I used to love him as a wrestler, man.
He was my guy.
Yeah.
He was a legendary wrestler, first black champion, and he was a big guy.
Yeah,
6'5", 230 of solid muscle. Mm-hmm. And he had the bolo punch or the headbutt. When you're a kid wrestling, it was the thing I used to watch with my grandmother who spoke no English, because you didn't need a language for wrestling. Mm-hmm. You know, just look out behind you. That's how it went. And so I used to watch it with her, and it was at the Olympic Auditorium, which wasn't too far from my house. And so my best friend Jesse, who lived across the street, right across the street from the school, his mother did Bobo Brazil's laundry. Mm-hmm. And so he used to pull up every other week in a big, long, white Cadillac convertible with zebra seat covers. Yeah. Oh, man, he was good. And the whole school would rush over to his car, and Jesse, being, you know, my best friend, he would call us over to the fence and give us a quarter. Mm-hmm. And me being the best friend, I got a quarter too.
Yeah.
And the whole school was there. It was like my first brush with show business. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm into this.
Yeah.
You know, it was great.
When did you know? I mean, there's some great stories in here about how you and Chong actually got together with the club that he owned.
And maybe
you'll tell some of that. But when did you know that entertainment was what you were destined to do?
First grade.
Yeah.
First grade, maybe kindergarten.
Yeah.
I was in the Christmas play for the class, and we were singing Up on the Rooftop, boom, boom, boom. And for some reason, I got chosen to play the kettle drum. And I was the littlest guy, so you couldn't see me. The kettle drum. The other thing we had these bands, a paper band with a gold star, and all you could see was this little gold star bouncing around and everything. And then up on the house, and this little hand with a mouth, boom, 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 and everybody started laughing, and I didn't know why they were laughing. And so the next time it came around, boom, boom, boom again, and bigger laughter. And then by the end, they were convulsing, you know. And I said, hey, well, this works. I could do this. All I need is a mallet.
And you've been hitting ever since.
Yeah, you know, it was just, I knew that I was destined. I was a little kid singer when I was 5 years old. I made my first record. Mm-hmm. And I was an anomaly. I was a little kid that could sing in tune.
Yeah.
Squeaky,
but
in tune.
Yeah.
And I was, you know.
Yeah. When we think of your work over the years, we think clearly of the Mexican, Hispanic, Chicano influences.
Yeah.
And yet I want to go back to that neighborhood you grew up in South Central. How much did black culture influence your stuff?
It was one of the primary influences on my early life, you know, because the music, it was next street over from Central Avenue, which all was happening. Johnny Otis used to play down the street. And R&B, I didn't hear any other music besides R&B. And growing up, and that's my sense of humor came from that relaxed attitude. And Tommy, the same thing. Mm-hmm. He grew up in Canada and found the only black neighborhood in Calgary. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, really, I swear to God. It was in Amber Valley, and then all this neighborhood came from Texas.
Yeah.
And they said, what's the farthest away from Texas we can get on this money? Mm-hmm. And they ended up in Canada's place, Amber Valley, and his wife, Maxine, was from, and her brother, Floyd Snead, who was the drummer for Three Dog Night, eventually became. So there again, Tommy was immersed in that R&B scene, you know, black music, recorded from Motown, and has those kids, Radon or Robbie. And so it was always, that's how we understood each other, a lot of that, because we understood, okay, well, and it's the rhythm. The rhythm of the cadence of that comedy, you know, that can be half dozens and half insightful at the same time.
Yeah. Before I let you go, tell me a bit about the decision you made to sort of go solo.
Yeah.
And obviously it worked out, you're acting, you've been on all kind of hit TV shows. And I mean, but sometimes when you step, and there are plenty of examples of this, people step out and it doesn't quite work out. But you stepped away and it worked out and you guys have come back together when you needed to. But tell me about, just tell me about the journey of going solo and being so successful.
Well, you know, I had a lot of confidence in doing that. It wasn't like I couldn't write and direct and star in a movie. I'd been doing that all through the movies, whether credited or not, didn't matter to me. But I, as far as being able to lift 100 pounds, I've been lifting 100 pounds every day since I remember. So I knew I could do it. It was nice to get a chance to make that kind of political commentary in this kind of street comedy. You know, I'm a classic picaro. Charlie Chaplin, Cantinflas, they were picaros, guys who lived by their wits on the streets, had a certain amount of charm and a certain amount of rascalness, and that's who I was. And I knew I could do it, and I knew that the audience was ready for it. Man. It was like, it was cool. It felt good.
Growing up in South Central, did you ever have any idea that it would turn out to be this good for you all these years later?
Well, you know, I just wanted to have a job. Somebody's gonna pay me to sing. And watch this. You know? Like, I mean, I was always a good student. You know, I was a straight A student in school and blah blah blah. But I was a teacher's worst nightmare. I was a straight A student who was a wise ass. You know, they couldn't shut me up, and they couldn't fail me.
You still got it all these years later. The book is called Cheech is not my real name, but don't call me Chong. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Amal Asante is a British film director whose credits include the critically acclaimed film Belle, which was inspired by the life of the mixed-race daughter of a British aristocrat. Her latest film is called A United Kingdom. It tells the true story of a romance between an African prince and a white British clerk that sparked both an international crisis and transformative change in the world. Before our conversation, here now a clip from A United Kingdom.
Uncle, this is Ruth.
I'm very pleased to meet you, sir.
I will speak to my nephew alone. Refreshments will be provided for him in the house. Over 2 decades of preparing you to be our king, and this is how you face me. A white woman by your side. Uncle. Are you trying to tear us apart?
So I whispered to Alma during the clip, I said, his uncle wasn't no joke. And you said to me, he reminded you of your father.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, you know, he gave me that look all the time, first of all. But also there was just this sense that David and I were talking about this, that, you know, there are certain African family members, male family members, that you just don't play with. And I wanted that feeling with this uncle. I wanted him to be a man who, when you saw him and you saw Soretse and Ruth walking towards him, you knew this was not going to be easy.
Yeah.
You know, burst the bubble.
There are two parts of this story. There are at least two parts of this story. And I'm curious from a director's point of view, how you, pardon the pun, married these two things together, which is the story of the political ramifications that this marriage had and the love affair. So there's a love story here, and there's some serious political ramifications, not just for this country, for the continent as well. How did you weave those things?
Well, it was interesting. When I came onto the project, there had been lots of conversation about how this story should be told and the balance of those two things. And I think that everybody had come down on the side of, well, it should really be mainly a love story, and the political stuff should really just form a backdrop. I felt really differently about it, mainly because of the important period of time where this story was taking place, which is when India had formed its independence, and Africans, you know, there was a feeling in Africa that this could be a possibility for many of the African countries too. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to have the politics, we needed to have the African politics. We also needed, in order to understand the power of this couple's love, to understand exactly what that love was up against. Mm-hmm. If you didn't understand what they were up against, you didn't understand how the strength of that love. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was important to know what the stakes were in terms of Britain being just post-war, being poor, needing cheap gold from South Africa, mm-hmm. to underline its economy, uranium because of a Cold War that was unfolding, and Britain's atomic bomb program. And the Prime Minister of the UK at that time had been given a mandate to take care of Britain's future. And then on the other hand, you had this couple who fell in love at a very uncomfortable time. Mm-hmm. And so my view was that as long as we saw everything through the prism of the love story, as long as we saw all of the politics always through the prism of the love story, mm-hmm. then we would be okay. But you needed one to emphasize the other.
Yeah. I've said many times on this program, it always gets me in trouble, so here I get in trouble again. I've been to 16 or 17 African countries, but the Ghanaian people are the nicest folk on the planet.
I agree with you. I am not about to disagree
with
that.
Yeah, I figured being a Ghanaian by birth, you might agree with that. But I love the Ghanaian people. I've been to the country so many times. Mm. And I wondered, given my love and respect for Kwame Nkrumah, mm. and Ghana being the first country basically to get its own independence, how on a personal level that increased your willingness or interest or the way you saw this story, yeah. about this particular country?
It was so important to me. When I came to the project, Soretse had no inner story, no uh-huh. inner journey towards his decisions to give up his kingship and become a leader in a different way if his country would vote for him, mm-hmm. and to hopefully take his country into independence. And the reason why it was so important for me is because my dad stood in Independence Square in 1957 and he saw the Gold Coast become Ghana and he waved that flag. And I was raised, you know, able to recite some of the speeches of Kwame Nkrumah. Mm-hmm. My father was a Pan-Africanist and he believed in a United States of Africa. And so although he wasn't a politician, he was a political man. And I understood on a very personal level what independence meant to my parents who were raised in a colony and saw it become independent. I understood what it meant to them for their country to become the master of its own fate. Mm-hmm. Hence, you know that is injected into the movie. And you know, the first time we hear that phrase in the story, it's in a small moment, a personal moment between the couple, and the final time you hear it in the movie, it's at the end, and it has a bigger world meaning to it. And it was important for me to be able to tell one African country's story, journey towards independence, because I am that daughter of Africa.
Yeah. David Oyelowo, your star, was here.
Yeah.
And we had a bit of a conversation about this that I want to carry over if I can to you, because
sure.
I want to get your take on
sure.
this.
Sure.
Which is whether or not something has changed or is changing amongst moviegoers, where we are now more at peace seeing this kind of interracial love on screen. There are a number of movies out, I think, of Loving and
yeah.
other stories.
Yeah.
And again, you guys are making movies. You don't know what's coming out when. You're doing your project.
Yes.
But it seems to me that there is this, I don't want to overstate it, but there is this openness, I hope, that we see. I mean, you tell me, am I right? Am I wrong?
I think we're in a better place than
okay.
we have been.
Right.
But we're not there yet.
Okay.
It's not. I'm not sure what David said, but certainly from my point of view, I don't think we're there
mm-hmm.
yet. I mean, in my world, the relevance of an interracial story is, in terms of filmmaking, is only for the sake of being able to sometimes show characters of color that are isolated,
mm-hmm.
have to find a way of asserting their identity in a world where they don't see that identity reflected back at them.
Mm-hmm.
That often happens in European stories where
mm-hmm.
there's a person of color. And in those times, yeah, there is an interracial element to a relationship they
mm-hmm.
might have. It's difficult. We're getting to a better place, but we're not there yet. I don't think everybody's completely comfortable, and it comes from all sides.
Who's more progressive on this question, the UK or the US?
Probably the UK.
Yeah.
Probably the UK. And I think that has everything to do with the history of how African people came to each of these, each of the continents, really. Yeah. And to a certain extent, it matters that people of color, in large part, came to the UK in recent history because they wanted to, mm-hmm. as opposed to being taken. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Since I loved Belle, as you know, I love one of my favorite movies ever now. I loved Belle.
Thank you.
Since the theme of race is present clearly in both films,
yes.
two different pieces,
yes.
both beautifully done by you.
Yeah.
But since race is present in the storyline of both pieces, what did you learn, to the extent you did, what did you learn from the journey of Belle that helped you on A United Kingdom?
Well, what I learned to be even more subversive.
Mm. I love that. I love that.
In the way that I tell my stories.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you get a bit of a love story in Belle, mm-hmm. but I hope the main thing that you walk away with, the main love story that you walk away with is a woman's love for herself, mm-hmm. a woman learning to love herself and understanding her own value and the importance of that value. Mm-hmm. And I learned to do that in hopefully subtle ways that mm-hmm. engage a filmic audience. Here, the love story is so important in A United Kingdom. It's the driving force of the narrative in many ways. But what I hope you walk away with big time is an understanding that Africa was, you know, countries in Africa were functioning before they became colonies, mm-hmm. that they had a sense of politics. Democracy was not something that was introduced from outside. Democracy mm-hmm. existed. It's shown very clearly in A United Kingdom that our traditions have always been important to us and we hold on to them for really important reasons. And so I hope that there is a real understanding, a better understanding for people who haven't been to Africa, don't know very much mm-hmm. about Africa, don't know very much about people of color who have resided or have emerged from Africa, that that Africa has a relevance to it that we don't often get to see on screen.
Yeah. Why, where, when, how did you develop this courage to take these risks in your storytelling? Because I could think of any number of other routes you could have taken as a filmmaker.
Yeah, sure.
But you've chosen to tell stories that have, not just in the story itself, but to tell the story means that you have to take some risk.
Yeah.
Why take the risk?
You know, I'm a broke filmmaker. I don't make any money out of this, but I tell the stories that are important to me, and it's usually those elements that I'm being subversive about that are important to me. I think we all have to have a purpose in life. That's what keeps us going. And my purpose in life is to connect with my fellow human being on issues that matter, on anything that allows us to connect over a common humanity. Mm-hmm. And we talk about this a lot, you know, on the films that I work on, how being culturally specific is really important, but understanding that universal humanity that is supposed to connect us all really matters to me. And I have no idea how I came to be born like this, but I know I was born this way, and I'm compelled to tell these stories because I think there is a greater good attached to them.
A United Kingdom is a powerful story. It's a beautiful film. I promise you would not be disappointed in it. And Ms. Asante has acquitted herself once again with a fine directing job. So thank you for coming to see us, and thank you for the film.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Folk singer and songwriter Arlo Guthrie came to prominence after the release of his debut album, Alice's Restaurant, back in 1967. Like his father, the folk music legend Woody Guthrie, Arlo's music focuses on social justice and activism. Arlo Guthrie, it is an honor, sir.
My pleasure.
To have you on this great program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me start with this, because I was just tickled when I came across this. So his father, Woody, wrote a song called Old Man Trump. Yes, that Trump. about his racist landlord, Fred Trump, who happened to be, as you know, Donald's father. It's one of the lines in the song, and I quote, "I suppose that old man Trump knows just how much racial hate he stirred up in that blood pot of human hearts when he drawed that color line here at his Beach Haven family project," close quote. So your father lived in a Trump building.
Me too. That's where I grew up.
That's where you grew up. And your father had something to say about old man Trump.
Yes, he did.
What do you make of that coincidence all these years later?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it, because first of all, I get a lot of stuff that says, oh, Arlo Guthrie, he's just like his dad, you know, and so I understand what that's like, to have somebody place you in a guilt by association. And so I, when my sister, Nora, found these lyrics, she asked me if I wanted to do something. I said, no. There's enough to dislike about the president without having to go back to his dad.
Yeah. So, but somebody put this to music, though, yes?
Yeah, my son-in-law did, Johnny Irian did some a really good cut of it, and some others have done that as well. Yeah. So I'm happy they did it. It's just not my thing.
It's not your thing. So since you went there, how have you managed all these years being the son of Woody Guthrie, finding your own artistic
genius?
Well,
you know what? I came to the conclusion at some point when I was very young that I was my own person. I just knew that somehow. And maybe it's because there were so many people that used to come to our house when I was a little kid. And they would dress like my dad. They would talk like my dad. They would write songs like my dad. They would do all of these things, but they weren't him. You know? And at some point I realized that even though you might admire somebody, and you might draw from some inspiration from them, you can't be them.
Yeah.
And it's no less true for me than it is for anybody else. And so I always thought the kind of things we're doing is the kind of things my dad dreamed of. You know, I've taken my family, all my wife and kids and all that, out on the road. We've done tours together and the grandkids. And that was a dream that my dad and mom had.
Yeah.
They never got to do it.
Yeah.
So I get to do stuff that they dreamed about. And it's not the same as pretending to be him, but you can't run away from it, you know?
But in the midst of all of that, Arlo, how did you find your own voice?
Mostly by accident.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a singer. I didn't want to be a songwriter. I didn't want to be an entertainer. I wanted to be a forest ranger. And I didn't like being around large crowds of people. And I thought, yeah, man, forestry. I'll sit on a mountain in Montana or something, wait for a fire every couple of years. You know, and then every night I wanted to, sort of in my dreams, sit on the back porch and play music with some friends. I actually went to school in Billings to do just that. And it just didn't work out.
Yeah. You got pulled in anyway.
This life is a karmic disaster. What are you going to do? But I didn't mean to be me.
Right.
But at some point I realized that I was dealing with something that was bigger than me.
When did you stop resisting the call, the vocation?
I left Montana in the fall of 1965, and I went to visit some friends that owned an old church, and got involved taking out their garbage. And the tale, that was 65, the tale I told about it sort of took about a year to put together. So Alice's Restaurant took about a year. And then I performed it in the summer of 1967 at the Newport Folk Festival. Mm-hmm. And I remember I wasn't scheduled to play there.
Yeah.
I went there with my guitar like all the other people. And but then at some point they said, okay, we're going to have to, you know, put you on the main stage. You got to sing that song, man.
Mm-hmm.
I said, really? They said, yeah. So I remember Pete Seeger and some others saying, you know, he's a young kid. He may not be able to handle this, you know, crowd out there. It's like, you know, thousands, thousands of people.
Yeah.
And so they said, at the end of the song, let's just, he has a little part that goes, if one person does it, if two people do it, if 50 people do it. So let's just go out, we'll send out, you know, some friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of that thing, everybody who had performed at that festival is out there singing the song with me. I got back from that, and it was like a switch had gone off.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, the old days are over. My dreams are shot.
Yeah.
We're doing something else now.
And bam, there you have it. 50 years later, yeah. Alice's Restaurant has just been re-released. It's amazing how these stories come to be, man. 50 yep. years since you did that.
I can't even remember. The only thing I remember about the original was that we recorded it in a studio, but with a live audience.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no take two.
Yeah.
There's no let's do it again.
Yeah.
There's no let's fix that. And everybody that had been invited to that studio recording had already heard the song. It's supposed to be a funny song.
Mm-hmm.
They had already heard it 100 times.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing funny about it to them. And every time I hear that original record, I hear, you know, that audience going, you know, it drives me crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And yet, as I said, you couldn't stop it. Was it Victor Hugo who said that there is nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come? When it came, you couldn't resist it. It's just, you had to own it, man.
No, I remember dealing with it and my mom telling me, you know, Arlo, if you really want to do this,
yeah.
You better learn to do something else because the audience is fickle.
Yeah.
They can like you one day, not yeah. like you the next day. And I remember thinking about that and I said, nope, my mom is wrong. If I know how to do something else and the times get bad, I'll do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I refused to do anything else. I refused to learn anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. So
you didn't have no fallback.
And that when the times got bad,
yeah.
and they do,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
from time to time, there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And I just kept doing it.
Kept
so
doing
here
it.
We are.
Yeah. Kind of like me. I ain't got but one talent.
That's it. Hey,
and that's questionable. But anyway,
you got a good one.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Tell me about your friendship with Pete Seeger. Because you mentioned him earlier in this conversation, and so it's not enough that your daddy is Woody Guthrie. Then you're hanging out and become best friends with Pete Seeger for year after year after year.
I remember the first time I went to visit Pete and his wife Toshi,
mm-hmm.
I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And we went out, we were living in Queens at that time,
mm-hmm.
in New York, and we went out to their place. Pete had built a log cabin on a high bluff over the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, whoa. This is like Davy Crockett stuff or something, you know. And so we got there, and I was really excited. And I remember my mom saying, okay, Arlo, go out and play with the other kids. So I wasn't hanging out with Pete Seeger. I was hanging out with his kids like any family, you
mm-hmm.
know. But over the years, and I thinking maybe in the mid-60s to the late-60s, that time when there were so many people out on the streets,
mm-hmm.
so many things going on. There was, you know, end the war, ban the bomb, change the lingerie, do this and all that, whatever
mm-hmm.
it was. And Pete was always there. And you could hear that banjo of his from blocks away. I remember walking through Washington, D.C., and I could hear his banjo and him, you know, singing. And there's no other instrument like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met up with him at all of these different things. And then in the late 60s, we started doing these annual shows together at Carnegie Hall in
mm-hmm.
New York around Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that. The last one we did together was just a few months before he passed away. He was 94.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't even walk out on the stage. He had these two canes and he was getting out there. And that audience wouldn't let him do anything. They were just up. I mean, I've never heard an audience just cheer
mm-hmm.
and clap and yell for 5, 10 minutes. It kept going. We couldn't even get the show going.
What did you see? What did you sense in that moment of appreciation for Pete Seeger?
That Pete was right. There's a power in music that most people underestimate. And you wouldn't know it, really, by what you like. It's what you don't like that shows you how powerful it is. Mm-hmm. In the old Soviet Union, there was pieces by Beethoven that were banned. Mm-hmm. Why is that? There's no words in there, mm-hmm. but there's a spirit in there that comes out. And unless you're the kind of person who says, I don't want to hear that, or that's dangerous. You know, when you're threatened by something, that's how you know the power of it, not when you're just sitting back mm-hmm. having a cocktail on a beach somewhere and there's mm-hmm. music playing in the background. That won't get your attention. Mm-hmm. But when something threatens you, you know it's what it is. And it occurred to me that Pete always knew that. He always knew that there was a power in the songs, there was a spirit in people singing together, and he proved it over and over again, and I think that audience that night at Carnegie and all of the shows he's done throughout his life helped build that conviction in him so that it was even more powerful because not only did he believe it, he could actually see it.
Does folk music, we are once again in a time of war, does folk music, does music writ large, still have that kind of persuasive, poignant power in it?
It depends on how you identify folk music. For me, okay. folk music is the original social media. Mm. That's the way people used to find out what was going on.
I take it, yeah.
And when I was a kid, I remember hearing the recordings of people like my dad and others, buddies of his, who had come from these rural areas where folk music was the only news they had. Mm-hmm. And they would write songs that might be making fun of the town over the hill, saying, you know, we're not dumb like those guys, you know. And you still see some of that in vestiges of like sports teams or something like that, you know, where you build yourself up by putting somebody else down.
Kind of bravado, yeah.
That happened throughout the history of music, but it was local. And then all of a sudden, somewhere in the 30s, we started building up a national music scene. And recordings of those kind of songs couldn't be played because they would make somebody angry over in the next town. You had to play the kind of songs that didn't offend anybody. Mm-hmm. And so the songs got dumber and dumber, as it were. And it's only recently, because of the internet and things like that, that you can hear those kinds of songs. So there's but you wouldn't necessarily associate it with a guy like me and a guitar. It might be some kids in some city somewhere doing their own kind of music. They're talking about what's going on. They're talking about what's happening. Mm-hmm. You don't associate that with folk music, but I would.
But back in the day, people at this level, not the kids on the internet, people at this level were speaking that truth to power. And for that matter, speaking truth to the powerless, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie, Bob Dylan, we can run the list. At this level, they were doing that. Do you see artists in this moment, at this level, who are doing that?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, they're always there.
Right.
But they're not always popular.
Right.
You know, there was this sort of glitch in the system mm-hmm. that happened in the during the 60s. Like a lot of other things, music was only one part of it.
Right.
And not only did the music speak truth to power, it also talked to each other. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. We were talking to other people, but it wasn't just the music in those days. The guys that did the fashion, the guys mm-hmm. that did theater, the guys that did art, the guys that did all, we all knew each other. Mm-hmm. We were all hanging out with each other. And now it's all sort of target marketed so that, you know, there's music for you if you're 15 or 16. You got your own channel, man. You got your own radio. You got your own TV. You got your own stores to go. So we don't have that kind of integration that we had, not only in the music scene, but we don't have it in the world anymore. And it'll get back there because that's a normal human kind of instinctual draw that draws you into people who may be doing a whole different world of art or a different world of what you're wearing or how you look or what you speak like or what language you're talking. Those people find their way together. Mm-hmm. Just takes a little while.
Yeah. What do you appreciate most about growing up in the era that you grew up in? We talked about the household you grew up in, the people you got to know because you were in the right household. What do you most appreciate, Arlo, about growing up in the era that you grew up in?
What I was just talking about.
Yeah.
There was this worldwide event that took place in the early 60s. I don't know what it was, by the way. Mm-hmm. And everybody who says they know what it was, they're making it up.
Mm-hmm.
It was, but I can tell you this. It didn't come from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
It came from the bottom up. And I remember the newspapers and the TVs and the radios all trying to identify, especially the politicians,
mm-hmm.
who are these people and who's leading them.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have any leaders.
Mm-hmm.
It was a groundswell. And so they made up leaders. And we all bought it.
Mm-hmm.
That one there, that's a leader, you know. Well, when you have leaders, you can, and everybody accepts that,
mm-hmm.
then it's easy to change what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have leaders, and so nobody could change anything. Because even at the Women's March that they just had in Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C., they had all these speakers and talkers and organizers, but most of the people in that crowd didn't know who they were,
mm-hmm.
never heard of them before. But those are the people the media goes to and says, that's a leader, it's their fault there's all these women out there
mm-hmm.
in the street. And I think that was the one thing I felt personally was the most interesting thing, is that it couldn't be identified.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a change in consciousness. Something happened, something shifted. It changed everybody. And it didn't even change everybody, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It just changed, and it didn't even change most people.
Mm-hmm.
It changed a critical mass.
Just enough, yeah.
Just enough.
Just enough, yeah.
And that's what I'm looking for today. I see the same thing happening right now.
Yeah.
There is not a majority. There is not most. There's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if everybody who feels that enoughness
mm-hmm.
is willing to get out there and say, me too,
mm-hmm.
I'm in this, it will change faster than anybody can imagine.
Is there a lesson or lessons for that group of enough in this moment to take from the group of enough in your era? Are there lessons that you ought to learn?
I don't think there's any lessons you can learn.
Okay.
Everybody's going to reinvent the wheel no matter what you say.
Okay.
No matter what I say.
Okay.
They're all, and I remember I was walking down the street with Pete when he was 92, mm-hmm. 93. That was during the Occupy thing in
mm-hmm.
New York.
In Ducati Park, yeah.
And Pete wanted to go.
Yeah.
And it was after a show that we had just done together. And I'm looking at him like, Pete, are you kidding me? I mean, now's the time to go out and have a beer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, we're going to meet those kids, you know. I said, okay, you know, whatever Pete wants, you
know.
So I'm following him down the street. He's got these two metal canes, and he's walking 30 blocks. It's like in November. It's cold. And he's got this funny little hat on. And he gets to, we were meeting them in the middle, sort of like
mm-hmm.
Columbus Circle. So there were a bunch of young kids coming up town, and we was going downtown. We met Columbus Circle. Nobody knew who he was. Nobody recognized him. Nobody had learned anything from him. They were singing songs that they knew like snippets of, a couple of words, and that was it. And then they'd move on to the next song because nobody knew enough to keep the same song going. But there's Pete.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got that banjo.
Yeah, yeah.
And he starts playing, and all of a sudden, all these young people that had never heard of him.
Yeah.
Start looking like, who's that guy? And there was something magnetic. He drew them in.
Yeah.
He'd been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
He starts singing the songs, and he starts giving them the words so that they could follow along, and all of a sudden there's a spirit thing going on.
Oh yeah.
It's a heart thing.
Oh,
you feel
yeah.
like, oh man, I'm here and something's happening.
Oh yeah.
That changes you.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the chemistry in your brain. It changes your heart. It changes everything. So I was not even concerned after that whether this particular movement, as
yeah.
if you want to call it, was going to succeed or not.
Yeah.
That wasn't the point of it.
Yeah.
The point was to change everybody who was there so that they would have some of what you're asking about, which is this initial experience.
Mm-hmm.
It took us years in the early 60s, time after time, thing after thing, place after place, to get that spirit organized
mm-hmm.
to where you knew how you fit in and you knew that you counted. That took a long time. But it's already started.
Yeah.
It started not just with those folks, but, you know, other people in different places.
Yeah.
If I would have imagined at some point that all I am is toast and done when I'm out of here, why bother? But there's something else going on. And I'm not a theologian, so I don't know what it is. I don't even care. It's not my interest. My sense is just to acknowledge it. If it comes to you to figure out, great, yippee. And if it doesn't, you don't belong there anyhow. So there are a lot of people trying to get something. There are a lot of people trying to understand. A lot of people trying to believe or trying to have faith or trying to. You don't need to try anything. It's all there. All you have to do is not be close to it if it should ever come upon you. Like those moments that we were just talking about with Pete, it comes upon, it finds its way into your life somehow, through somebody, circumstance you couldn't predict. It comes. And that's all you need to know.
And let yourself be a vessel.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
I love this guy. It's been 50 years since Alice's Restaurant was first performed at Newport, the Folk Festival, and there's a special version of it out now on the 50th anniversary of this great classic. Since you happen to bring your instrument with you, would you be kind enough, sir, to play us out with something?
In times like these, when night surrounds me and I am weary and my heart is worn and the songs they're singing don't mean nothing, cheap refrains play on and on. The storm is here, the lightning flashes between commercials, they're taking names, and singers run to where the cash is, just another link in slavery's chain. I see the storm clouds rise above me, the sky is dark and the night has come. I walk alone along this highway where strangers gather one by one.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.